Today is Tuesday, November 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, will talks in Geneva achieve any sort of chance for peace in Syria?
We're not even sure that the Syrians have turned up yet. The last I saw in the media anyway was that they were still holding back their delegation.
President Trump's latest controversy over comments about Native Americans.
They call her Pocahontas.
Is the internet, as Americans know it, about to change? Also ahead, another royal wedding is on the horizon. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the White House is denying President Donald Trump uttered a racial slur during an Oval Office event Monday honoring some Native American military veterans during an event to honor World War II code talkers from the Navajo tribe. Trump made this ad-libbed remark to the five elderly Marine Corps veterans.
You were here long before any of us were here. Although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you because you are special. You are special people. You are really incredible people.
Trump again referring to Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas, the name of the famous reputed daughter of an early 17th century tribal chief. During Monday's White House press briefing, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, when asked about the comments by a reporter, said this.
At the event that the president just did with the Navajo code talkers, he referred to Pocahontas being in the Senate. Why did he feel the need to say something that is offensive to many people while honoring the Navajo code talkers, these genuine American
I think
heroes?
What most people find offensive is Senator Warren lying about her heritage to advance her career.
Now, she said it was a racial slur. She said it was a racial slur. What is your response to that?
I think that's a ridiculous response.
Trump repeatedly called Warren by that name during his campaign for the presidency, saying she lied about her genealogy. Warren, in the past, had said her mother was part Cherokee and part Delaware. That's a U.S. state, but acknowledged no documentation for her lineage. Having proof of even a trace of Native American or other minority lineage in the United States can allow someone to claim preferred status in college and job applications. The Federal Communications Commission chairman has followed through on his pledge to repeal 2015 regulations designed to ensure that internet service providers treat all online content and apps equally, setting up a showdown with consumer groups and internet companies who fear the move will stifle competition and innovation. Joining me now to discuss is internet and cyberspace attorney Salar Atrazada. First, thanks for being with us. Explain to us exactly what is net neutrality.
Well, net neutrality is the principle that internet service providers and government should treat all web-related traffic equally, regardless of the source. So if there was no net neutrality, then companies could purchase priority access to customers. Also, large companies can pay internet service providers to provide customers more reliable access to their websites instead of a competitor's website.
What are the possible changes that are coming, and how likely is it to happen?
So this new change or proposed change will allow internet service providers to stop or slow down the delivery of websites to end users. They can also charge customers extra fees for high-quality streaming or other services. And under the proposed changes, internet service providers will be able to block, slow down, or speed up service for business partners as long as they notify customers.
So why should people care about this issue, and what does it mean for the general population here in the U.S.?
We should care because rolling back the rules makes telecom companies powerful gatekeepers to information. The proposed changes will allow the internet service providers to offer their services at higher prices. And these new proposed changes can permit telecom companies to engage in quote-unquote favoritism by charging consumers for accessing some websites or by slowing speed to others. And as a result, I believe, it's my personal opinion, that the general public should expect higher fees if they want higher quality access to websites that count on high-speed connections for streaming videos like Netflix and those types of providers.
Why would the FCC want to change it?
Well, that's a good question. This is basically the FCC has been dealing with this kind of issue for the past year or more. The current chairman of the FCC plans to roll back the net neutrality regulations that were implemented in the Obama administration. So they have different perspectives. The FCC is now trying to deregulate basically the net neutrality as it applies to telecom companies and service providers, including Google, Facebook, and the other ones. And the telecom companies are basically for it, for deregulation, and other companies, including the service providers and search engines, are most likely against it. So the FCC, which is a governmental agency, deals with these types of issues and has been given the right and the power to regulate or deregulate these types of transactions.
What happens once net neutrality rules bite the dust?
Well, I wouldn't think that it would be completely removed, but it could be partially removed. We'll just have to see how Congress and FCC handle this type of issue at this point. But I think that, like I mentioned, the changes will allow internet service providers to block, slow down, or speed up services. They can also charge customers extra fees for streaming or other types of services or products. So the change will most likely impact the consumers and the general public, most likely with higher fees. And it could be lower too. It doesn't have to be all higher, but the cost will vary.
That's internet and cyberspace attorney Salar Acharzada. Thank you so much for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Turkey is demanding Trump honor a purported pledge to cut off weapons to the Kurdish militia. The UN asks Brazil for peacekeepers for Central African Republic. U.S. Senate Republicans are pressing ahead on a tax vote. And the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments in a pivotal case for digital privacy. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A breakthrough in the UN-backed Syria peace talks seems no more likely than the 7 rounds of earlier talks, as President Bashar al-Assad pushes for total military victory and his opponents stick by their demand that he leave power. A Syrian newspaper reports that the government delegation is delaying its planned arrival in Geneva because of the opposition's insistence Assad step down. UN Syria mediator Stefan de Mistura Monday expressed optimism that after recent fighting in Syria, this could be the time to reach a political settlement.
I did say after Raqqa, after Deir ez-Zor, and let us now perhaps say also after the government of Syria defeated ISIS recently in the last stronghold of Abu Kamal, the operation to combat and defeat ISIS' territorial foothold in Syria would have completed its main tasks. And there would be a moment of truth for bringing about a real political process. I still believe that the moment of truth has arrived.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks Anthony Billingsley, the Mideast analyst at the University of New South Wales, where things actually stand.
We're not even sure that the Syrians have turned up yet. The last I saw in the media anyway was that they were still holding back their delegation, perhaps in part because they want to continue their assault on the Ghouta area near Damascus. But you're running against that, the conference or the meetings that the Russians are organizing with Iran and Turkey. And really what you're talking about is one conference which is effectively powerless but has the moral authority of the United Nations, and the other one which is effectively reflecting the so far the winners in the Syrian conflict. And that's where the action, I think, is taking place.
A Syrian newspaper reports the government delegation was delaying its planned Tuesday arrival in Geneva because of the opposition's insistence that Bashar al-Assad step down.
The opposition is represented by the High Negotiation Committee, which is very suspiciously was meeting in Riyadh, which is a bad look to start with. The head of that committee resigned because of great pressure on him to accept that Assad not be removed. So I think basically everybody apart from some of the opposition groups and perhaps the US have accepted that Assad need not necessarily go. And so there's a fundamental problem there if the Geneva talks are going to make any progress.
Well, the opposition's stance is seen by Damascus and its allies as divorced from reality after the government's steady march of victory since Russia ended the war in 2015. The rebels have been forced from all the big cities. Their hopes of toppling Mr. Assad by military means looks finished. What do you think?
Well, certainly I think it is divorced from reality. The government, thanks to the Russians in particular and the Iranians, have made really significant gains over much of the country. They still don't control all of it, including around in the Ghouta area near Damascus. But the government is obviously feeling very confident of its longer-term capacity. As far as I can see, the only U.S. policy that is perhaps being pursued is the idea that Syria not be able to unite under the Assad regime. And I think that's also not really facing reality.
Russia is pushing its own parallel track of diplomacy since early this year, bringing together the other main ally of Syria, Iran, as well as Turkey, which has been backing the rebels. Russia has elections next year. President Putin wants to show progress toward a political deal after 2 years of fighting. Do you think that's fairly accurate?
Yes, I think so. Plus, they must be feeling particularly confident now that, you know, that the reality on the ground is much more favorable to the Syrian position. It's interesting that so far the Russians and the Turks have been able to paper over differences, and to an extent the Russians have conceded Turkish demands about a sort of safe zone in the north of the country, although I suspect that that relationship will be fairly brittle over time. But he would, I'm sure, like to be able to present a significant an announcement of an all-Syrian Congress, which is what he's talking about, to which all forces in Syria, outside Syria, for the government, against the government, would be invited to take part and to engage.
Well, you have the UN track on the one hand, you have Moscow's Syrian Congress on the other, which the opposition appears not interested in taking part in. Will either one of these bear fruit and finally bring this conflict to an end?
I mean, it's a pretty appalling solution, but to the extent that the Russians can stop the fighting, they've done that in some areas through the most brutal means possible or imaginable. But yes, to an extent, I think the Russian approach is probably more likely, unless the United States were to engage in the Geneva arm. And so far they haven't. I mean, it's noticeable that Tillerson, for example, has been basically nowhere to be seen on the on this issue, and that's the comparison with Kerry is really quite dramatic. But it's that sort of U.S. engagement, I think, that would give the Geneva talks any real traction in this process.
That's Anthony Billingsley, Mideast analyst at the University of New South Wales. Elders at a village in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, where militants killed 305 people in a mosque, had been warned by Islamic State operatives to stop collaborating with security forces and suspend rituals associated with Islam's mystical Sufi movement. The latest warning came as recently as a week ago, telling villagers in Al-Rawda not to hold Sufi rituals to commemorate the birth of the Prophet Muhammad. Egypt's military and security forces have been waging a tough and costly campaign against militants in the towns. Across the country, thousands have been arrested in a crackdown on suspected Islamists and other dissenters and government critics. Joining me now, Professor Amin Saikal, Director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Is this indeed, as it looks, the work of Islamic State?
Well, similar attacks have been carried out before, perhaps not of this magnitude. And we know that, for example, the Russian passenger plane had been shot down, you know, a couple of years ago over Sinai or just off Sinai, and all the passengers had been killed. So it does bear the hallmark of an attack by Islamic State, but it is quite unusual that the Islamic State has not publicly claimed it yet.
Right, because normally they like the credit, right?
That's right. They do make a quick statement and try to gain credit for these sort of tragic activities.
It is the deadliest militant attack in modern Egyptian history. The military has been carrying out airstrikes. Do you think that this will have an impact?
Well, the Egyptian military has been very active against these militants over a long period of time, and they've been carrying out many operations, particularly in northern Sinai, but they have not really paid off so far. It seems that the military has not been able to really contain the growth of this sort of insurgency, which has come to dominate not only Sinai, but also make an impact in the rest of the Egypt. And, of course, the roots of it may well really go back to the turmoil that Egypt faced in the wake of the fall of Mubarak's dictatorship and then the eventual success of the Muslim Brotherhood and the demise of Muslim Brotherhood by President Sisi and his supporters. And to me, it appears that I think this is what really created the environment which has allowed this sort of militant group to find a niche, particularly in Sinai.
Why on the Sufi Muslims in particular?
These people they see Sufis as the heretics, people who've adopted a different way of worshipping God through ecstasy, chanting, dancing, and so on, which they do not really believe, and they therefore think that these people are not very good Muslims.
And witnesses describe seeing about 24 assailants descending on this mosque in 5 all-terrain vehicles. That seems pretty high tech.
Well, it does, and it looks like that it was an elaborate operation, and it must have been really been in planning for some time, because this sort of operations do not emerge overnight, and therefore it looks like that the group is have been very well equipped and also very much in planning this operation for quite a while.
President Trump said in a tweet that this attack, he equated it with the U.S. need for a border wall with Mexico. Do you agree with that?
Well, not necessarily, simply because I think the violence across the border with Mexico has never been on this scale, and there have been a number of migrants who may have crossed the border illegally, and they may have been stopped or may have been arrested, or for that matter, some of them may have been shot dead in a confrontation that they may have had with the border security forces. But this is a really different type of operations, and I don't think that this sort of attack necessarily really justifies any suggestion that the border between the United States and Mexico has become as violent as this sort of operations may indicate.
Anything else maybe we should point out here with this situation?
Well, I just wanted to make the point that I think military operations on the part of the Egyptian security forces may work up to a point, but beyond that, I think they will need to have a really comprehensive political strategy in order to be able to find a way whereby these people could be moderated and could be incorporated into the political system. I mean, as long as the political system remains very tightly controlled and very much closed, then there is a little avenue for these sort of individuals to externalize their anger, externalize their demands through legal channels. And I think it's important that some legal and constitutional channels would have to be really opened to these sort of people in order to pull the rug from under their feet.
That's Professor Amin Saikal with the Australian National University. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, having a tattoo is no longer just a symbol of being in a criminal gang. Famous celebrities showed off their inked bodies, show tattoos. They're becoming more mainstream in many cultures. An increasing number of people see them as an art form. They've got a history, though, that spans thousands of years across many cultures. VOA's Elizabeth Lee visits a new traveling exhibit at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County.
Chuy Quintanar has been creating art on living canvas for more than 20 years.
When I first started tattooing, it was still looked at as a bad thing. But I always saw tattooing as an art form.
When a museum asked him to contribute a piece to the exhibit called Tattoo, he knew tattoo's negative image was changing.
It was it's like a dream to be in a prestigious museum.
This exhibition is one of the very first exhibitions on tattoo that come from people from the tattoo culture. All the other ones, and there have been a number of them, were put together by doctors or criminologists.
The exhibit shows tattoos from Asia to Africa to the Americas.
It's something that goes across cultures, thousands of years, and it's basically a universal impulse and practice. There's lots of reasons that people may have tattooed in the past and certainly tattooed today, whether it's to mark a rite of passage, to mark a moment in time that's important to them.
This exhibit shows examples of the many reasons why people go through this painful process, from a Congolese tattoo to video of this ritual in Thailand.
Tattoo has a strong spiritual and religious purpose in a lot of cultures, where the tattoos themselves have a power.
A tattoo can be a sign of defiance, shame, or honor.
One of the main use of tattooing was to mark people down and to exclude them and to punish them. A traditional tattoo is a tattoo that you don't choose and you don't decide on. It's a tattoo that your group, your family, your people decide it's time for you to have.
This exhibit not only looks at the history of global tattoos, it also features the colorful tattoo scene in Los Angeles, and guests even have opportunities to get a tattoo here at the museum. The exhibit not only showcases LA's modern tattoo culture, it also shows its history.
The Pike became a place where all the sailors were coming home from Asia, and they were kind of exchanging tattoos that they had received when they were in Asia.
The Pike, a waterfront amusement park off the coast, was a popular place for LA's early tattoo scene. Then the black and gray tattoo style emerged from East Los Angeles, an area that's largely Latino.
The black and gray style, the Chicano style, it's called. And that's the style that I do.
Quintanar says he's wanted to show his art to the world, and now he can. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Britain's royal family has officially announced the engagement of Prince Harry to American actress Meghan Markle. She's best known for her role in the U.S. TV legal drama Suits. The 33-year-old Harry, currently fifth in line to the British throne, and 36-year-old Markle became engaged earlier this month with a wedding planned for spring of 2018. English author Claudia Joseph talks about the comparisons to another royal romance that was, at the time, a sort of forbidden love.
And now Harry is marrying an Afro-American. He's marrying a divorced woman. I think people look at him and remember perhaps Princess Margaret and Peter Townend and her sad life as a result of perhaps not being able to marry him, and think, well, Harry has to make his own choices in life, otherwise he's never going to have a successful marriage.
The couple met in July of 2016 after they were introduced through friends. Well, wildfires that swept through Northern California in early October killed 42 people, destroying hundreds of homes and causing an estimated $6 billion worth of damage to the region. The fires also frozen an income stream the region relies on tourism. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
This is what regional winemakers want tourists to think about when they think of Napa, California.
The train is running, the wine is flowing, we're on our way.
But these images from October wildfires are what seem to be sticking in people's heads at the moment. The October fires were devastating, but the wine industry was relatively undamaged. Of the 1,200 wineries in the region, only 10 were seriously damaged.
No wineries lost really very much wine from this vintage. It was really more the impact that the fires had on people's psyche. In the films, they thought the Napa Valley was burning, so they canceled their trips. And that's really been the most impact for us.
Hotels are much quieter than usual, and a lot of rooms are filled with people who lost their homes in the fire. That's costing businesses money every day. That's prompting local leaders and winemakers to get out the word. Napa and nearby Sonoma are still here and open for business.
Spend money at our local restaurants and shops, buy Sonoma wines, stay at our hotels. That's one of the best ways I think you can really help get the destination back on track.
While the wine industry was spared, smoke damage and loss of tourism dollars may end up having a much longer-term effect on the regional farms and wineries.
We always save for the rainy day. But in this case, you know, we're not really saving for firestorms. And it's had a tremendous financial impact on us.
To help get the word out, the California Tourism Commission is unveiling a $2 million ad campaign that hopefully will start bringing the tourists back to the region. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On his recent trip to Sudan, Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan stressed that the United States remains committed to engagement with Sudan on a wide range of topics, including the protection of religious freedom and the promotion of other human rights throughout Sudan. In June 2016, Sudan and the United States initiated the so-called five-track engagement plan that required the Sudanese government to cease hostilities in Darfur and the two areas of South Kordofan and Blue Nile states, improve humanitarian access throughout Sudan, refrain from interfering in South Sudan and play a constructive role in regional peace efforts, cooperate with regional efforts to counter the Lord's Resistance Army, and build U.S.-Sudanese cooperation on counterterrorism. In each area, the government of Sudan has made measurable progress. As a result, the United States revoked certain U.S. sanctions on Sudan. But the completion of the five-track engagement plan, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan, is only a first step on a longer road toward fully normalizing our bilateral relations. For Sudan to become a full partner of the United States, it must seek peace within its borders and with its neighbors, and cooperate reliably with the international community to improve security and prosperity in the region and adhere to long-standing international norms, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. In the years ahead, one measure of the strength of the U.S.-Sudanese relationship will be improvements in Sudan's respect for human rights, and in particular, religious freedom. Interfaith understanding, respect, and the protection of religious freedom and other human rights are bulwarks against extremism, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. When governments favor a specific religious, ethnic, or sectarian group over others, violent radicalism thrives. The United States calls on Sudan to protect political opposition members, human rights defenders, civil society groups, and the media. We also urge the government to hold accountable all who are responsible for human rights abuses, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. The U.S. looks forward to working with Sudan to promote a more peaceful and prosperous Sudan, a Sudan that respects the rights of persons of every faith.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.